From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week at the United Nations, a week-long debate over a global strategy to combat terrorism. The big question, how can the world defeat an enemy it can't define? British Ambassador Sir Jeremy Greenstock.
Increasingly, questions are being raised about the problem of the definition of a terrorist. Let us be wise and focused about this. Terrorism is terrorism.
But as the saying goes, a saying ever more fraught with dangerous political implications, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. The delegates at the UN agreed that the mass murders committed in New York and Washington were acts of terrorism, but there was no agreement on similar acts committed in other places for other reasons. Malaysian Ambassador Hazmi Agam.
Acts of pure terrorism involving attacks against innocent civilian populations, which cannot be justified under any circumstances, should be differentiated from the legitimate struggles of peoples under colonial or alien domination and foreign occupation.
So we proceed to the latest installment in our occasional series called Word Watch. This week, it's terrorism. Stephen Sloan is the author of The Historical Dictionary of Terrorism and a professor at the University of Oklahoma. He says the roots of terrorism are as ancient as the idea of empire.
We often look at, for a start, the zealots who used daggers to spread consternation among Roman occupiers during the biblical period, to spread fear to a broader audience, the general public, which is a major theme of terrorism because it's aimed at those who survive, and obviously that has a profound impact on what we just experienced.
When did the word terrorism first appear?
It really appeared during the French Revolution, what was called the Great Terror, under Robespierre. What Robespierre did was focus on the emergence of state terrorism.
You mean terrorism committed by the regime?
That's right. The systematic use of terror to enforce compliance to the regime's dictates.
How has the concept or the word become part of world history since then?
During the Russian Revolution, before the Russian Revolution, too, you had Russian anarchists who practiced terrorism. And it was interesting, a number of them were very careful not to get civilians targeted. As a matter of fact, on occasion, they would not have missions because of that. So they initially tried to be more selective. Certainly the word, I think, has really become very significant. I would use, in the modern age, the Munich Massacre as the beginning of modern terrorism.
By the Munich Massacre, you mean an extremist group that targeted the Israeli wrestling team at the Munich Olympics.
That's exactly right. And the reason it became a defining moment, I think, was twofold. One, the terrorists were using as their mode of operations aircraft. In essence, they were delivery systems to launch attacks at an area far away from their disputed homeland. But secondly, and I think this is much more significant, the Munich Massacre spread fear and intimidation to a global audience because through the medium of television, the perpetrators got their message across to a global audience. And I think that's what was particularly significant about it. And also, the Germans could not effectively react to that. And in the deaths that followed, which included the Israeli athletes, we understood that we had a long way to go to deal with what was then a very new threat.
Professor Sloan, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Stephen Sloan is a political science professor at the University of Oklahoma and co-author of The Historical Dictionary of Terrorism. William Salatin is a senior writer for Slate.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
The Bush administration has declared war on terrorism, and in a speech following the attacks, the president described the terrorists as people who, quote, hate our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other. But that, whether or not we wish to argue its truth, is rhetoric for public consumption. If we were to apply that standard to our war on terrorism, how would that affect the coalition we're trying to create?
Well, let's start with the most basic core of the coalition in the Middle East. That would be the countries of Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. All three of those countries, if you look at the most recent State Department Human Rights Report, have violated all of the principles that President Bush enumerated in his speech. They violate the freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of vote. their secret police abuse human rights. So right away, we're not defining our coalition by all the countries in it upholding those values.
When you look at countries like China and Russia, the Chechen rebellion has been responsible for acts of terror throughout Moscow and throughout Russia. You have an Islamic independence movement causing a lot of trouble for the Chinese. They regard these as terrorist movements, and they would like the coalition to regard them as terrorist movements. Will that cause a problem, that broader definition?
Yeah. Imagine that there is some kind of ideal definition of terrorism that's really accurate and fair. You could apply it around the world. Even on that assumption, that definition is like a tightrope, and you can easily fall off on either side of it. You can get pulled by coalition politics in the direction of making your definition too narrow. For example, we need the Syrians and the Iranians in our coalition, so we tell them, look, right now we're just going to define terrorism as Osama bin Laden. Our definition of terrorism does not include Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad, which you guys support. On the other hand, we got countries like Russia and China, which want us to broaden the definition of terrorism and start throwing into it people like the Chechen rebels, against whom we hold the Russian government responsible for atrocities. But somehow now we're supposed to look the other way and allow the Russians to perpetrate these atrocities because, hey, those rebels must be terrorists too, right? We wink at Vladimir Putin while he persecutes the Chechens in exchange for his support against bin Laden.
President Bush may have tried to address this a bit in his speech when he talked about pursuing terrorist movements of global reach. Now, that would presumably leave out the Chechens and leave out the Islamic independent movements in China.
Yes, that definition would, in principle, leave out the Chechen rebels. But that's just principle. What's happening in the real world is that the Bush administration has already started changing its language about our objections to the Russian persecution of the Chechens to basically say, be nice. Please, Russia, be nice to the Chechens, rather than our objections being stated in much stronger and more substantive terms.
So how do journalists deal with this loaded word as they proceed to try to cover a war with an enemy that is so difficult to identify, unless we simply identify the enemy as the people who protect and carry out the desires of cells run by Osama bin Laden? That's pretty darn specific.
We're not going to settle this question anytime soon. And instead of trying to determine the meaning of that word at the outset, we should constantly ask our government officials to square the term as they're using it with American policies. For example, we could say to our Pentagon and State Department spokesman, wait a minute, we're forming a coalition against terrorism, but you're trying to include Syria, which supports Hamas, or you're trying to include Iran, which supports Islamic Jihad. Are they not states that sponsor terrorism? How are you preventing them from continuing that kind of terrorism? Those kinds of questions will at least keep our government honest, and my bet is that if we keep asking those questions, the way that the government uses the term will change, or the government will have to modify its policies to make them consistent with the words that it's using.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
On September 11th, Slate.com's Jacob Weisberg wrote, quote, "My honest, churlish reaction, I wish Bill Clinton were still president." That week, Weisberg questioned whether he, as a pundit, should have questioned the president. Jacob Weisberg, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Brooke.
So, spare us the suspense. What did you decide?
Well, I did decide right after that I should refrain from criticizing Bush, at least at the level of his leadership ability. And I did refrain for several weeks. In fact, I still haven't written anything critical of his leadership, although at the moment I'm not sure I have anything critical to say. The place I've really arrived at now is that I think criticism should not be withheld. I may not have any strong criticism to make of the president at the moment, but I do think commentators, analysts do owe it to the public to basically say what they think.
Well, on our program a couple of weeks ago, L.A. Times TV critic Howard Rosenberg said that he regrets the timing of his criticism, critiquing Bush in the days immediately following the attacks. Of course, Bill Maher has apologized profusely for his politically incorrect comments, which were delivered in the days immediately following the attacks. While understandable, are all these mea culpas laudable? After all, what's the point of being politically incorrect only when it doesn't matter anyway?
Well, it's hard to say if that's sincere when Bill Maher is threatened with the loss of commercial sponsorship, which would take his program off the air. Obviously, he has to apologize profusely if he wants to have a hope of continuing.
But you, in a sense, apologized, and Howard Rosenberg, who had no threat of being fired, also felt sincerely sorry that he said what he said.
No, that's right, and I really did. I wrote that on the first day. I happened to live fairly close to the World Trade Center, and it was a very long day for me. I was evacuated with my family and sat down at a friend's computer to bat something out for Slate.
You admitted at the time in your column that it was a churlish thought, but it was honest, and it was your own, and it was immediate. Why regret it? Why not make it part of the public record? It's how some people felt.
It's not that I didn't think it, but I wish my reaction had been totally focused elsewhere.
You also wrote that the immediate criticism of Bush, which was widely denounced, might have actually had the effect of convincing the president and his advisors that some leadership was lacking. But it doesn't seem as if the Bush team really cares about what the critics say.
I think if there had been no criticism of Bush's actions and words on the first day or two, which in fact many people did think were inadequate to the situation, would Bush and his advisors have had a sense that they had to do better, that they had to make a speech as strong as he did eventually make to Congress a week later? Criticism plays an important role as feedback for leaders, and if critics feel that they can't criticize, they may in fact be cheating the people they are critical of.
You wrote in your article that, you know, this isn't a time for critics to throw bombs. Temperate criticism is the order of the day. The editor of the National Review said the other day that Ann Coulter is gone because she's an incendiary columnist whose sole purpose is to provide entertainment value by lobbing bombs. And so lobbing bombs is not what a columnist is to do today. Does that mean no more criticisms of style?
Well, I'm not sure there's any good time for Ann Coulter. But I do think that criticism shouldn't be as much about style and personality, and it shouldn't be small-minded, and it shouldn't be petty.
And do you think, then, that the nature of criticism in this next period is likely to change from what it's been?
Well, I don't know. In ordinary times, I think it's a fairly sound journalistic instinct to say things in the strongest way possible, to use that phrase, which seems so inappropriate now, to throw bombs. My argument is an argument for some sense of self-restraint, some sense of decorum, but I'm not very certain whether many people who write are going to sort of follow those precepts or not.
Jacob Weisberg, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jacob Weisberg is the chief political correspondent for Slate.com. Coming up, another victim of terror, the first journalist murdered in Northern Ireland, and selling tolerance to the masses.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Fact A, journalists have been excoriated for appearing to be insufficiently supportive of the president in time of national crisis. Fact B, a consortium of the country's largest news organizations was prepared to release its analysis of the disputed presidential race in Florida, but has postponed that release in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks. It sounds suspicious, but are there sound journalistic reasons for putting a story of such import to American democracy on hold? Here to discuss the matter is Dan Keating, a database editor at The Washington Post, one of the consortium members. Dan, welcome to OTM.
Glad to be here.
Let's begin, but why don't you just tell me what the consortium is and how it was going about its business?
It's a group of news organizations that got together right when the Supreme Court made its decision and the recount ended essentially all of the news organizations were interested in saying what is on those ballots and just answering the question for history. And that group is the Associated Press, CNN, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The Washington Post, Tribune Company, The Palm Beach Post, and The St. Pete Times. So we got together. We hired the National Opinion Research Center, which is the nation's foremost field survey research organization, and we hired them to go out and view all the ballots. And then we also have worked as a group collectively on devising the schemes for reviewing those ballots and determining whether there might be voter intent that could be drawn from those.
The consortium was poised before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon to announce its findings. And lo and behold, I happened to notice it in a story by Richard Burke in the Week in Review section of the New York Times. He just mentions almost in passing that the publication of the results and the analysis was delayed. And in fact, to use his words, on hold indefinitely. What happened?
We had a group of people that were going to be working on this, as each other news organization did. And those people are doing other things right now that pertain mostly to the September 11th attack. And until those people are freed up and the space that we would dedicate in the newspaper is freed up, we obviously can't do it.
Yeah. Is it a news hole issue, a physical space in the paper that you can't devote to,
well,
to take out the substantial?
I think we could probably get space in the back of a section somewhere. But having put as much time and effort into this because we think it was important, we want to publish it in a way that conveys that importance. And right now, it's not going to muscle its way into a prominent place. And the other thing is, I mean, right now, simply the nation's attention is focused on certain issues. It'd be kind of like publishing your big annual baseball wrap-up on Super Bowl weekend.
But is that it alone? Is it just a question of the nation's interest, or is one of the considerations the nation's mood? If the results of this consortium's work, for example, were to suggest that President Bush won his job under dubious circumstances, is there a concern at the Washington Post or anywhere else in the consortium that this would be regarded as disrespectful or disloyal?
I don't really think that's a relevant issue. Although we were close to publishing, we actually had not had delivered to us the data from National Opinion Research Center. We do not know. And National Opinion Center does not either, because they did not do anything that would be like a tabulation. All they did was a description. They have no software to convert those descriptions into potential recount votes or not. So they have the data, but they have no way of counting them. We have the counters written as software programs, but we do not have the data. So because the two have never been joined, nobody on earth knows what that data shows. You know, the amusing thing to me is that for a long time we were having to answer the question, why are you doing this? And now we're having to answer the question, why aren't you doing it? And nobody wants to see this published more than the people who've spent literally months and months and months of time working on it.
Now, I understand you're the database editor, you're not the managing editor, but what other stories have been pushed aside in the aftermath of the attacks and the preparations for war?
Journalists don't usually like to talk about stories that are in production, but it's safe to assume that the entire political, investigative, foreign, business, staff, resources that are now being applied to the aftermath of the attacks were all busily employed on September 10th. So a lot of things that were being done are not being done right now. And in fact, there were some major projects that were like published right before it that kind of did not reverberate with the effect they usually would have simply because people's attention was drawn away.
In fact, I seem to remember an installment one in a series about how the District of Columbia government's Child Protective Services.
That was a four-part series. It was a year-long investigation into why all these children died who were under the care of the government due to negligence and errors and other things. It started on Sunday, and it ran on the front page Sunday and Monday, and then it ran on the front page as well Tuesday, and then on Wednesday it ran in the Metro section. And given what a brilliant investigation it was and what important things it revealed, it would normally have caused repercussions. And while there has been some reaction to it, it's not anywhere near the magnitude you would normally get simply because people's attention is focused elsewhere.
Because news usurps news.
Exactly. And the news business is not sympathetic to things. You know, the news business doesn't say, well, you know, this isn't an important story, but we're going to pay attention to it anyway because we should. It's just the same as like campaign finance reform in Congress right now. It's not that it's ceased to be an issue. It's just that right now there are more pressing issues. And we don't want to publish our big project at a time when people aren't going to pay attention to it, and it's just going to fade away.
Very well. Dan Keating, thank you very much.
Oh, glad to do it.
Dan Keating is a database editor at The Washington Post.
In Northern Ireland, 30 years of terror claimed another victim last Saturday. Reporter Martin O'Hagan specialized in the underworld in Belfast, and it was there that the Red Hand Defenders, a loyalist or Protestant paramilitary group, shot him dead in a drive-by attack. Just another murder on the books, but not, of course, to his colleague Richard Sullivan, who worked with him on the outspoken tabloid called The Sunday World.
Martin O'Hagan was a dedicated professional journalist, but above all, was a good guy. He was a good husband, a father to three lovely daughters, and just somebody who lived what I would call a good life and who was committed to what he did for a living.
Now, it's been 30 years since this latest round in the struggle over Northern Ireland began. About 3,600 people have lost their lives, but there had never been a journalist until now. Why do you think Martin O'Hagan was the first?
He was very much what we would call a classic investigative reporter. And in this part of the world, if you're an investigative reporter, you investigate terrorist organizations. They got him because he was too close to the truth.
But certainly journalists have gotten close to the truth before. How come they've been given a pass by the terrorists until now?
I think we've all thought, we've all believed that there was almost an unwritten code that they recognized what we did for a living and what we had to do. We weren't safe. We've all been threatened. We've all been in the middle of this for a long, long time, but we never felt that we would be deliberately targeted as such.
Is it because they needed you?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think, yeah, they needed us, and to an extent they used us as we used them for stories. But I really just think that we all felt that there was a recognition that journalists were trying to deliver news to both sides of the community here. And as such, we probably wouldn't be targeted for murder.
Is the Sunday World regarded as a pro-Catholic paper?
By very nature of the conflict here, papers are traditionally unionist or traditionally nationalist Republican. We are not like that. We expose loyalist paramilitaries. We expose Republican terrorists. So we annoy both sides in equal measure, if I can put it like that.
How has O'Hagan's death changed the atmosphere in your newsroom?
There's a void in here. No news editor before me or my editor have ever had to deal with the fact that we've lost one of our reporters. So it's a very unreal feeling. But underlining it all is a complete determination to continue to expose these people, not to step back from what we've done for the last 30 years.
Do you think that feeling is felt throughout newsrooms in Northern Ireland? Or do you think that people may hang back because of this?
The messages of support that we have got from our colleagues in other papers and broadcast media is very much keep going, we're all in this together, and the murder of Marty was an attack on us all, not just the Sunday World, and I would agree with that this was an attack on free speech, and we're all in that game, and that is very much the feeling that I'm coming across. We're all in this together.
Martin O'Hagan's death is just one among 3,600 deaths. Do you think his death will have any impact on the peace process?
There have been so many watersheds in Northern Ireland, so many awful atrocities, and so many times we've said that this can't happen again, this is surely going to change things, and so many times we've been let down, and it has gone on. But this time I feel that they've crossed a line, and I'm not just saying this because Marty was one of our own. I get the feeling, and from talking to members of the public, from talking to members of the political establishment, that this has now got to stop. There are no rules anymore. Where do you now draw the line in the sand?
As someone who works in Lower Manhattan, six blocks from the World Trade Center, that sense of line in the sand is felt everywhere. And on the other hand, also that sense that there's no real resolution.
We sat and watched the pictures from New York, and like everybody, every other decent person in the world, we were utterly horrified. And may I say that we send our complete condolences and sympathy to the people of New York. But We know what that feels like. We have lost 3,600 people out of a population of only 1.4 million. If you extrapolate that in a comparative number, that's 480,000 U.S. citizens. We have felt a frustration that it has been tolerated by the rest of the world, and it has been allowed to continue. And now the powers that be realize that we must sit up and do something about this. This is the scourge of the world at the moment, and we have lived with it for a very long time, right on our doorstep, every day, and it's an awful way to live.
Richard Sullivan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Sullivan is the news editor of The Sunday World. Recently, a series of public service announcements has begun to air on television and radio stations promoting a message of tolerance. It's one of the most visible efforts to combat discrimination and hate crimes against Muslims and Arab Americans. And as Michelle Breyer reports, the PSAs are part of a larger public relations campaign for a community that now finds itself under siege.
It was perhaps the best publicity Muslims and Arab Americans could have dreamed of. NBC's popular White House drama, The West Wing, this week aired a special episode dealing with the aftermath of the September 11th attacks with an overt message of tolerance. Entitled Isaac and Ishmael, the story focused on a group of students and their questions about terrorism. In this scene, Deputy Chief of Staff Josh Lyman, played by Bradley Whitford, offers his explanation of why the terrorists hate America.
Street corners lined church, next to synagogue, next to mosque, newspapers that can print anything they want, and women who can do anything they want. This is a plural society. That means we accept more than one idea. It offends them.
The program also tried to correct some of the misconceptions about Islam, a religion that many Americans have come to equate with violence and anti-U.S. policies.
There is the assumption of collective guilt.
Dr. James Zogby is president of the Arab American Institute in Washington, D.C. He says the general public knew little about Muslims or Arab Americans before September 11th, and now misinformation and fear is filling in the gaps. Media coverage can be blamed for adding to the confusion, says Richard Lehrmer, a public relations expert in New York City.
Unless you are educated or really spend a lot of time reading, you know, The Economist and Harper's and what have you, where they actually break these things down, you're getting tabloid press, and the tabloid press has done a very bad job of discerning between the cultists, as I call them, the people that were running the missions that, you know, killed so many people here in New York, and the rest of these practicing Muslims.
Muslim leaders in the U.S. say the lack of information has prompted a backlash against anyone who even looks Middle Eastern. Adina Lekovich is a spokeswoman for the Muslim Public Affairs Council based in Los Angeles.
Our community is trying to deal with the loss as anyone else is of their family and friends, and yet they're being faced with this double burden of being associated with criminals. And as much as we try to make clear the distinction between people who act in the name of faith for political purposes, that distinction isn't getting across to all Americans.
Lehrmer says what Arab Americans and Muslims need to do right now to fix that is launch a massive public relations campaign. He suggests the community first must identify a spokesperson with stature.
A visionary must come forth and speak to the American people about the problem. And the problem is that the people who are the cultists that have destroyed the World Trade Center, they're not speaking from the Quran. They're not Islamics. They're nuts.
He adds there isn't any obvious choice for someone to stand out in front to defend Islam. But the Arab American Institute's James Zogby says many prominent Arab Americans are stepping forward.
It's a wonderful collection of people, but people don't know that they're Arab American. Like Doug Flutie or Spencer Abraham or Jamie Farr or Bobby Rahal, the race car driver, all of them Arab Americans. People don't know that.
Even so, those names may not resonate with all Americans the way other ethnic and religious leaders might. Catholics, for example, have the Pope, while Scientologists count megastars like John Travolta and Tom Cruise among their members. Lehrmer points out that the most famous Muslim American, Muhammad Ali, is ill and cannot play the role of traditional spin doctor, although his appearances since the disaster have been moving. Zoghbi says it's not just well-known Arab and Muslim people speaking out in defense of Islam, Muslims, and Arab Americans. The radio and TV spots promoting unity that begin airing this week feature Attorney General John Ashcroft and pop singer Mandy Moore, among others.
We all know our country's experiencing rough times, but that's no reason to hate people who don't look like you. This is Mandy Moore, and I'm here to tell you that discrimination and violence against Arab and Muslim Americans is not what this country is about and will not be tolerated.
Moore is not a Muslim nor an Arab American.
Right, but she cares, and that's the great thing, is that people care to get out the right message.
While many publicity experts say these kinds of ads will certainly help, Richard Lammer points out that Muslims are on the defensive now.
It's not the preferable way to do PR, because you're already at a disadvantage. You're talking to people who already have their arms folded. They're not really that interested in hearing what you have to say because they already believe that they know the answer.
In the face of all that resistance, tolerance can be a tough sell. In the effort to get across the message, you can further victimize the group trying to have its voice heard and even alienate the audience. That's what the producers of The West Wing found out this week. The special episode was criticized for having a weak plot and pompous speeches. The Atlanta Journal and Constitution called it a somber civics lesson, while USA Today called it a crashing and condescending bore. And no one knows for sure if the program had any lasting impact in changing viewers' minds. For On the Media in New York, I'm Michelle Breyer.
We have heaps of email backed up because our offices in Lower Manhattan were evacuated and we only just now regained access to it. We still don't have the technical capacity to respond, so bear with us. We had some mail objecting to our interview last week with Pete Williams, a journalist turned Pentagon spokesman turned journalist again. We spoke to him about the relationship between the Pentagon and the press. You have to ask yourself, wrote Ramey Grunbaum of Seattle, whether such revolving door recruitment practices promote independent, energetic reporting. What's next? Mickey Mouse reporting on the theme park business? Charlton Heston covering the NRA? And we had a lot of letters in response to Bob's closing essay 2 weeks ago, in which he criticized some journalists, Dan Rather among them, for succumbing to jingoism at the expense of objectivity. Bob said journalism's job was to unravel, not to unfurl. Susan Smart of Pullman, Washington wrote, "Let me just say that if you receive flaming email, I will stand by with a fire hose. What Mr. Garfield said had to be said. I think it is extremely easy to take Dan Rather's attitude and just ask how high and how far to jump." But Laura Thompson of Thornton, New Hampshire wrote of Dan Rather, "Did you ever think that his statement to stand behind President Bush comes from 60-plus years of experience as an American and someone who wished to stand up for his country? Most media folk don't let their jobs define them. He hasn't, and America has rallied behind him for it. Unravel this." Please send your email to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Coming up, ad writers change their tone, and a conversation with Ted Koppel.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. True or false, a man escaped the collapse of World Trade Center Tower No. 2 by surfing 80 stories down the falling building on a piece of debris? Answer, false. It never happened. But millions think it did happen and repeat the story as gospel. Such is the power of urban legend, and events like the World Trade Center attacks are fertile ground for the escalation of rumor into widely held belief. Barbara Mickelson and her husband David run a website devoted to urban myths, and they're debunking. She joins us now. Barbara, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, glad to be here.
In the aftermath of the World Trade Center attacks, a number of rumors achieved currency. Can you give me some examples?
One of the big ones was a fake photograph, which seemed to show a tourist on the observation deck of one of the World Trade Centers. And you could see just behind him one of the airplanes about to strike the tower. And this was a particularly chilling photo simply because it appeared to show the last half second of this man's life and even the last half second of normalcy for all of us.
But
it was fake.
How did you find that out?
It was pretty easy to do just from looking at the photograph itself. The fellow who's standing on the observation deck was wearing a heavy winter coat and a wool cap, something nobody would have been wearing on that morning. We also were able to find out that the tower that he would have been standing on would have been the first struck, and yet it was the other tower that had the observation deck.
Why do you suppose that these myths do proliferate? Why do we wish to believe that there are alligators in the sewer systems, that Nostradamus had predicted the World Trade Center attacks? Why are we so gullible?
Well, in ordinary times, part of it is we just love a good rumor in the sense that we're part of something larger. But in times like these, times of crisis, we're desperately trying to make sense of a world that no longer makes any sense at all.
In the 6 years that you've spent unraveling these legends, is there anything else that you've learned about us?
Learned a great deal. Usually the body of legends that we're telling and passing around tend to form into a rather accurate reflection of what we as a society are currently thinking and feeling. And it's funny how that happens, because there's no one person sitting there cranking out the urban legends one after another. They generally happen as honest mishearings, misunderstandings, or misrememberings of stories and tales. But we tend to only pass along the stories that somehow or other resonate with us, and we tend not to repeat the stories that don't strike that chord with us. And therefore, the stories that stay in circulation end up being the ones that are very accurate reflections of the current heart of mankind.
So if the accumulation of urban legend is a kind of Rosetta Stone for the zeitgeist, looking at the legends that have been spawned by the World Trade Center attacks, what do you divine about the state of American society in the fall of 2001?
That we are quite frightened. There is a general sense of apprehension. There is horror and shock at events that have already unfolded, but there is a growing sense of apprehension and almost of inevitability towards events that may well unfold further down the road.
And if John Ashcroft doesn't make you feel that way, Nostradamus does.
Exactly. I mean, isn't it much easier to believe Nostradamus when he talks about two silver birds and twin towers than it is when John Ashcroft warns in a nebulous way that there may be further attacks?
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Barbara Mickelson and her husband David run the website called Snopes.com. September 11th may or may not have changed everything. 3 weeks later, the sitcoms are back, the late-night quips are back, and a gratuitously violent movie opens this weekend. But it is still September 11th for the world of advertising, where many images and jokes created before the attack have been rendered horrible double entendres. What once seemed innocuous, such as Coke's slogan, "Life tastes good," can seem trivial or insensitive. Joining us is John Frierson of Frierson & Partners in New York. He's just gone through the process of vetting his agency's entire pre-September 11th output, looking for the suddenly inappropriate. John, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, we've spoken on this show about how the TV networks have gone out of their way to remove all of the images that were suddenly rendered offensive by the World Trade Center disaster. Is the motivation for doing it any different in advertising than it is for programmers?
Well, I think it is somewhat different. I think advertisers spend a great deal of energy, time and energy, all on one single image. I mean, we can spend months and months perfecting an image in order to elicit a very specific emotional response. We had one ad that showed a lovely woman sort of gazing up into the sky, and she was looking through binoculars. It was a very spirited look, like all about the possibilities of life and things were, that were to come in the future. Well, suddenly in light of these events, she seemed like she was looking for something to happen, something that may not be good. So it just seemed to have a completely different nuance from what we thought it meant. In other cases, we've actually had entire campaigns that I think we've had to rethink because, for example, one of our clients, the core strategy of the brand was that this brand is about surprise. Well, I'm not sure people want to be surprised right now. So that means that really, in a way, regardless of the execution, whether it's a radio ad or a television ad or a print ad, we had to sort of rethink it.
What else don't people want to be right now besides surprised?
Well, I'm not sure that there's anything that's absolutely out of the question, but I do think the tone will change. Like I said, advertising is a business of nuance, and I think the nuance and the tone will change. I think people are going to be moving in the direction of things that are more about relationships with people that they love, about their families, things that matter suddenly matter more. So it's, I think some brands, you know, there's sort of a short-term reaction to this, which is this appropriate and is it appropriate now? But I think there's also sort of some long-term changes that will happen that you know, could affect brands differently from what they're thinking right now.
You've gone through this process of vetting all of what's previously had seemed innocuous images or at least inoffensive images. Have you learned anything about advertising? Learned anything about your craft that hadn't hitherto occurred to you?
Well, I learned that God is in the details. You know, we spend our days making incredibly minute decisions about color, about typefaces, about words, about exactly what the model looks like. All of these little decisions combine to create an emotional connection with the consumer. And when you start evaluating that through a very extreme magnifying glass, when you start evaluating that emotional connection, you start to see all those little details and you start to see how much they matter.
All right. John Frierson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Frierson is a partner in Frierson, Me and Partners in Lower Manhattan.
A student seeking the truth about how America's recent wars were waged and reported on will turn eventually to the books of David Halberstam, author of The Best and the Brightest and The Powers That Be. His latest book, War in a Time of Peace, deals with America's military campaigns in the 90s. He says television's foreign coverage in the last decade has been a casualty of the corporate takeover of the networks.
It's profound, and what happens when that takes place? The people who do your polling, and no one polls more than the networks, not even Bill Clinton, tell you that the American people do not care about foreign policy, where in the past an editor, an executive editor, a news executive at television was like a print editor, and he balanced, or she balanced, in the traditional way, the idea of what people wanted to know with what they needed to know.
In The Powers That Be, you wrote about the conduct of the media during the Vietnam War. This was before the change of ownership, when characters like David Sarnoff and Bill Paley were still there and willing to run their news operations sometimes, even as lost leaders.
Yes, I remember during the Vietnam War, the nation was obsessed by the war. It was, in my friend Michael Arlen's phrase, the living room war. So, in fact, covering it, a place where the whole country was fascinated, did not hurt ratings.
But that's when a lot of bad blood began to flow between news operations and the Pentagon.
Inevitably. I mean, inevitably, because we were covering and reporting on an unwinnable war in the wrong place at the wrong time. People at the Pentagon will prefer, by and large, a minimalist and sort of a somnolent press corps, you know, one that can be fed every day the way you feed the fish at the zoo.
Which brings us to the military actions of the 90s, the period covered in your book, Kosovo, Somalia, Haiti. The TV coverage, with some clear exceptions, was considerably less enlightening than that of Vietnam. Was TV news shut out, or did it choose, for the most part, to stay out?
The television reporting, by and large, reflected the overall American attitude that these things didn't matter. I think that the president, Clinton, was not particularly interested in upgrading ports of the Balkans because he was not acting on it. And some of the reporters who went there felt that the networks responded to that, that Washington was trying to cool it on the agenda, and that a lot of the network newsrooms take their signals from what the White House does and does not say is important.
Was television news less inclined to report news that was unfavorable to the U.S. government?
No, I don't think it's that. I think it's something different. I think it's television news responding to what it thinks people want. America wasn't overseas fighting, and therefore you wanted, the job was to drive the ratings up because you were going to try and drive the stock up.
Well, that brings us to today. How well prepared do you think the media is in terms of manpower, resources, historical memory, and even motivation to cover this coming uncertain phase in military and foreign affairs?
The question is really, what kind of citizens are people like Michael Eisner and Michael Jordan at the CBS and the heirs of Jack Welch going to be? Or are they going to be, are they going to be these same harsh norms of profit in order to drive the stock up? This is a very important question.
Okay. Well, David Halberstam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Halberstam is author of many books, including War in a Time of Peace. As has been widely noted, the events of September 11th snapped us into reality. 6 minutes before the first plane hit World Trade Center Tower No. 1, CNN aired a segment called Huge Buzz Surrounds Designer Liz Lang's Maternity Wear. While most outlets were busy scrapping their lighter fare, ABC's Nightline had to put on hold a multi-part documentary about the situation in the Congo. It was a rare case of TV programming that was inappropriate for reasons other than being frivolous. It was also typical of Nightline. The host of Nightline, Ted Koppel, joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Last week we had on Chris Kramer, who's the head of CNN International, and he wrote an op-ed piece in Le Monde which said, "The American networks have forgotten how to make international news interesting." Do you think it's that, or is it that generally the networks aren't encouraged to try?
I think to a certain extent it's a function of economic imperative. And one of the easiest ways to cut back the budget is to take a look at what costs the most and produces the least. And I think that's been the main cause. Are the networks still capable of doing interesting stories from overseas? You bet.
Do you think Nightline is a niche TV show, that there's just not a core audience in America for more programs like yours?
I don't know. I mean, it clearly is a niche program. I think by and large we do more serious programming than a lot of what gets on the magazine programs, for example. We would have been off the air a long time ago if we were in prime time because our ratings would not have been high enough. At 11:30 at night, they're just fine.
When we asked Don Hewitt about what should other news magazines do to achieve the stature of 60 Minutes, he said they can't because there's only one Mike Wallace, Ed Bradley, and so on. And he was happy that his show alone enjoyed that exalted status. Would you want a lot more shows that do essentially what your show does?
I'm not sure. On the one hand, I think it would be good if an audience would sit still for that kind of programming throughout other parts of the programming day. On the other hand, I'm a realist, and I know that if you had a program like Nightline and a series on the Eastern Congo, for example, up against West Wing or ER or whatever else is hot in programming right now, what's that CBS program, the really big one with the people out on the out in the brush trying to
Survivor?
Do each other in. Thank you, Survivor. I'm probably the only person in the Western world who has never watched it. But if we were up against that, we would do very poorly. They would kick our butts. I have no doubt of that.
You are the closest thing we have to a diplomat without portfolio, in that you talk to more leaders than anyone not employed by the State Department. If they give you an answer you don't like, you go after them. When interviewing a Taliban official, have you ever had the impulse to pull back simply because you are an American and castigating the Taliban might not be in our national interest? Would you, for instance, ask General Musharraf about India's charge that the government of Pakistan is itself a sponsor of terrorism?
Oh, sure. Why not? My function is not to go over there and either deliver a warning in behalf of my government or try to bring about some kind of a solution in behalf of my government. My function, and it, I think we're all well advised as journalists not to forget that, we don't operate as diplomats. I hate the term television diplomacy because it's an oxymoron. It doesn't exist. I mean, it sort of first came into popularity when Barbara Walters and Walter Cronkite interviewed Sadat and Begin, and there was sort of the world was left with the impression that they had arranged for these two men to meet together and that it never would have occurred to either one of those two guys that they could sit down and have a conversation if either Walter or Barbara hadn't mentioned it to them. That's nonsense. That's not our function. It's not what we do. We're out there to get information. We're out there to tell the story to the American public in as clean and direct a fashion as we can. If we don't do that, we deserve to be criticized. But we shouldn't be criticized for not being good diplomats. We're not supposed to be diplomats.
Now, in the interview we just heard, David Halberstam said that whether the networks continue to cover the story the way it should be covered depends on the character of people like the head of your network, Michael Eisner. What do you think?
Well, let's put it this way. Over the past few weeks, and Michael Eisner and I have not spoken during that time, and I don't know this from anyone inside Disney, but I think I read it in either Time or Newsweek the other day, that all of the three commercial networks lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $400-500 million, each of them, not collectively. And probably before this thing is over, will have endured well over $1 billion worth of losses in the interest of serving the public, and therefore the notion that it can sustain losses of an additional few $100 million every couple of months, I just don't think is realistic. Are they continuing to say, by all means, go ahead and cover this story properly? Yes, they are. Is it costing them more money than it was costing them before? Yes, it is. Are they going to be able to do this indefinitely? No, they're not. But fortunately, I don't have to worry about that.
And why not?
Because I just keep coming into work every day and taking home sacks of money at the end of every week, which this generous corporation gives me for being here every day.
Ted Koppel, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ted Koppel is the host of ABC's Nightline.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. Our thanks once again to WNET in New York for providing us a temporary home.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.